Hello, and welcome to Mornings with Joel, Commercial Real Estate Podcast, where we focus on rising stars and established players in commercial real estate and talk to them about how they are building legacies in today's marketplace. All right. So, hey, we'd like to welcome you all to the Mornings with Joel CRE Podcast. We're very excited today to have Jennifer Taylor with us. She represents the Asians that are kicking behind in commercial real estate. So we're happy to have her here today. And on top of that, being a woman, which you don't often see. So we're real excited about that. So Jennifer, how are you? Good morning.
I'm fantastic. Great to actually meet you in person last week.
Yeah, absolutely. That was pretty cool. So I was like, man, that girl looks familiar. And you would have won. So
it was good.
Yeah, absolutely. So for you who don't know, Jennifer Taylor is out on the West Coast, based out of Los Angeles, and doing some incredible things in commercial real estate. So let me introduce you right quick. And then Jennifer, I think you'll actually to the audience, I think you guys will understand why we asked Jennifer to be on this show today. But Jennifer, tell us a little bit of who you are and what you're currently doing in this industry.
First off, thanks for having me on your show, Joel. I actually went back to a few of your previous podcasts, and you've had some really impressive speakers. So, bravo to you and what you're doing. My name is Jennifer Taylor. I am an investor of an urban ambiculture real estate strategy. I cut my teeth in real estate about 30 years ago on the property operations side. So I managed both for institutional and non-institutional investors, primarily office and retail, in LA for the first decade of my career. And then I had the opportunity to pivot into what the institutions call investment management. So I find my deals, I underwrite them, and then I identify my debt and my equity partners. Most of the deals that I worked on have been in Hawaii and Los Angeles, but my investment thesis is investing and developing in markets with strong Asian demographics. And that's why I focus on the West Coast. Aside from what I do from a professional level, I'm also the board president of a group called FIRE, Filipinos in Institutional Real Estate, which has chapters. I think we have 10 chapters throughout the United States. And we just launched our first international chapter in the Philippines. And I think I mentioned to you, Joel, on our initial call that I'm also one of the founding board members of a group called ARAP, African American Real Estate Professionals, in the LA chapter. I do sit on a couple of other boards, a multicultural youth group called Swirls for Girls, and then a group called FACE, Filipinos Advancing Creative Education. And I just stepped off the board for one of the oldest and largest Filipino nonprofits called SIPA, Search to Involve Filipino Americans. So if you listen to what I'm doing and if you've seen what I've done, everything that I touch and feel has to have a multicultural component to it. Otherwise, it's not something that I'm interested in.
Okay. All right. Well, quite impressive. So, you know, again, as I mentioned, you guys will understand why I asked Jennifer to be here today. She is very, very busy and very active, and especially promoting Filipino and Asian culture. So quite interesting. So you said that you got started in real estate out in Los Angeles, but you were born in New Jersey. So how in the world did that happen? How did you wind up in LA? Or were you like everybody else who just wanted better weather?
So it was actually my parents, and I'm a typical, you know, immigrant story. My parents didn't even know each other in the Philippines. They met in New York in the 60s. They had my older sister there. They had me in Jersey. And then they decided they were done with the Nor'easters and wrapping babies to get them to the babysitter. And so they moved to LA. So I've been here. I mean, I'm not a native, but I consider myself a native because I've been here since I was two.
Okay. All right. Cool. So I understand that. So in your career, you said it primarily started as property management and operations management in commercial real estate. How did you find yourself into that space in the first place? Because, you know, as you know, there's not a lot of Asians that are actually in that aspect of the space, so of commercial real estate.
So when I started, it was 1993. And for a lot of folks that come, for a lot of diverse folks, there really was no path to a real estate career. So like everybody else that, you know, fell into it in the 80s and 90s, you literally stumbled onto commercial real estate. So I was a second year nursing student, of course, because I'm Filipino. and then I took a job answering telephones for an executive suites company in Pasadena. And then just from there, it, you know, it was I think like a rapid ascend in my book. So receptionist, admin assistant, assistant manager, property manager, general manager, and then a portfolio manager was the last thing that I did before I actually got into the investment side. So, you know, we're trying to be in this generation more intentional about getting students of diverse backgrounds into a path so that they really reap the benefits of a fruitful career in commercial real estate if they have that foundation.
Yeah, yeah, very good point. And that's kind of interesting, but I'm glad you brought that up because a lot of people, you know, they look at themselves and they say, well, I can never do that, right? And your evidence that, yeah, you can do it if you put forth the work and the effort and really get kind of laser focused on where you want to be. And you may not have identified with that initially, but obviously over time, you saw the path and the value of going down that road. So that's quite impressive from that standpoint. Now, I know you've been involved in some other deals yourself and have done some other transactions and whatnot. What challenges do you see are being faced by individuals today that are really trying to get deals done in the commercial real estate space?
I mean, I think it depends on what it is that you do. You know, I always come from this place of I've been, and I tell this to people that I mentor. You have to figure out if you're a K-1, a W-2, or a 1099, right? Very early on. I've always had this entrepreneurial spirit, but I was a W-2 for about 10 years. And that's where I gained the crux of my real estate experiences through working with other companies, both big and larger groups. So figuring out, do you have that appetite for risk? You know, are you a risk taker? Otherwise, you know, some folks go into the consulting space and want to be a 1099 type of individual. And you know, for most people, I commend this for this, a lot of people are, you know, safety and security. They want that W-2. So very early on, figure out what it is that you want to do. But I think that the challenge for somebody like myself, that's an entrepreneur, in this space of getting deals done, you have from an economic standpoint, right? You have several things working against you. Obviously, interest rates. If you're in development, cost of construction. But then, you know, accessing the capital has really been the biggest challenge for, let's just say, people of color. So I think you and I talked about this. If you look at these emerging manager programs, and for those that don't know what an emerging manager program is, they're primarily investors trying to access capital so that they could manage money on behalf of larger institutions. And so these programs were created, I think back in the 80s, specific to getting capital out to both female and minority groups to manage money for them. But there's always been, I mean, you know, we don't have to rehash what the problem is. Everybody knows about, you know, systematic racism that we, you know, both women and people of color have never really started at the same starting line as other folks that have that access to capital. So I think for me, the biggest challenge is trying to get to this place of equity and equality so that folks like us are that there's consideration given that we don't come from the same background or have the same resources in order to get to that starting line.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good point. You know, and that's really the crux of it. You know, I've met with a variety of pension funds, and generally what happens is the money gets allocated to a fund of funds, if you will. And then that fund of funds says, well, we can't find any eligible companies. And then that's pretty much it, you know, and it just kind of goes away. And, you know, it's been kind of sad. So there's been a lot of work to overturn that, but you don't always, you know, it takes time, I guess you could say, but, you know, when is time going to be up, right?
Well, listen, I'm going to share a story with you because I've, sure. You know, I've been at this for a little while. And one day, it's a couple of years ago, I came home really frustrated. I had just gotten back from New York, had a couple of meetings with different equity folks. And I was sharing with my husband that there's a woman of Asian background with a pension fund that has the power and the ability to allocate money to, you know, these different managers. Yet she continued to give the money to, you know, the same guys in Newport Beach that are raising their third fund and have $500 million AUM, right? Which to me is not an emerging manager. That is a full-blown manager. So I asked her the candid question that if, so it perpetuates the problem that we can never get money to the people that it's supposed to be allocated for because of that, because you're continuing to give money to those types of groups. And so, you know, she had said something like, we don't really, they don't really give credit for female or minorities. Everybody's considered the same. All they want you to do is perform. So I didn't want to get into it with her and go back into history as to why, you know, it isn't fair and why we are still here. And so I came home and I shared my disappointment with my husband, and he made me realize something. And he had said, the woman that you're talking to gets a bonus at the end of the year. Her bonus is based on performance and the people that she brings in and the returns that they get. Mm-hmm. Her point is the deals that she sees from these other guys get better returns than the deals that they see from folks like us. And so that for me was an aha moment. And I'm like, oh, okay, I get it. This woman has to pay tuition too. And in order for her to get to her full potential of her bonus, she has to go with a group that she knows tried and true is going to generate the returns historically that she's looking for. So at the end of the day, that, you know, it really, if you're out there looking for money, spend the time to figure out, are there groups that are focused solely on emerging managers to help our case and our cause? Otherwise, you're just going to run into these same frustrating meetings where there really is not much that they can do.
Yeah, you know, Jennifer, you mentioned two words that I want to circle back to. You mentioned tried and true and historically. And yes, you're 2,000% correct. It generally goes to the same old, well, I know they did this before, I'm going to do it again. And if anything blows up, I could always say, well, look, they're a gazillion dollar private equity fund, so I trusted them and, you know, let that be the end of the story. But what we found, and I'm sure you probably found this as well, is that in reality, the majority of the minority firms or BIPOC firms have actually outperformed a lot of their larger counterparts because they are more serious about what they're doing and more cautious because they know they might not never get another chance at this. And that's right. What the statistics actually showed, you know? Right. Have you found the same thing on your end?
Absolutely. I mean, if you go back into time, in this is really pathetic, but if you go back into time and look in the last 30 years, the managers of color that have reached that point that they're able to get allocations from these large institutions, you can count them on two hands. And to that extent, doesn't even fill up both hands, right? So we're talking about 30 years, people of color. I can't even, I don't really know of an Asian that's actually gotten to that point, but there are, you know, there are primarily black men led groups. I can think of maybe one or two women, but that's, you know, that's it. And so to see that laid out statistically against the different groups that have accessed capital over the last couple decades is, you know, again, I think quite pathetic.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's amazing because I think that is still the perception from the standpoint of, you know, we have that they're not going to perform as well, or we only have this money available for money that we, you know, we're basically okay with losing because we don't expect them to perform at a high enough level. And we really don't have an allocation for money we want to lose. And we're basically saying, look, we're not asking you to lose any money. We're not asking you to take lower returns. We're asking you to just give us the bat, let us step up to the plate. That's all we want, right?
Right. So, I mean, but, you know, add to that real quick, Joel, think about, let's just talk investment strategies for a second, right? Sure. You and I have the same friends, same colleagues that are breaking into this space or are already in this space, and look at their investment strategies, where they're investing in. So I think that a lot of these institutions that are looking to get into, you know, whether it's joint ventures or some type of program with diverse managers, are already assuming it's going to be an affordable housing strategy, right? Which yet again, you're now putting people of color back into a different box. It's just another box, right? So I think for me, my challenge has been a couple things. You know, aside from being a person of color and a woman, my investment strategy is focused on Asian Americans. And so really, I only focus on 85% of this country is made up of six Asian subgroups. So Chinese, Japanese, Filipinos, Koreans, Vietnamese, and Indians. That, and that's it. If there isn't a, if they don't fit into any of those markets, it's not something that I'm willing to explore. But the money that I'm trying to access is institutional money. Many of the folks that that control that money are probably not from an Asian American background. So I spend a lot of my time just on the research side of them and getting them up to speed on the demographics of Asian Americans, the emerging markets that these Asian Americans are in, the behavioral patterns of Asian Americans, the types of tenants that they are. That's just my own investment strategy. If you're Black or Hispanic, you're probably doing the same thing. And why are we doing the same thing? Because this is where our competitive edge is. Every deal that I've done has been an off-market deal. And it's because my community trusts me. It's probably the same thing with Blacks and Hispanics that are focused on the same type of investment strategy. They're getting first looks at these deals because they that's their competitive edge. We're not doing core deals. We have, I will never chase a core deal because I have no competitive edge in the core deal area, nor do I have core deal money. So the folks that we saw last week at the REIS program, we're all talking about new markets that these folks are not familiar with. So you're spending a lot of your time, in addition to marketing yourself, you're spending a lot of your time introducing them to markets that they historically don't know about.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay, get into. And I want to pivot a little bit and talk about something that you put on the table just a minute ago. Your firm is Ambiculture Advisors. And if this is a direct quote, taking Western U.S. real estate and combining it with concepts from Eastern parts of the world. So explain that a little bit for our audience. What exactly does that mean in real terms?
So when I was putting, just like every good business, right, you're always, you're trying to fill a void. And so and putting the thesis together, my thought was, if you look at where institutional money is already investing in urban markets, they're already in markets where Blacks and Hispanics are, but yet they haven't figured out the Asian focus. And so on the economic driver side, Asian Americans are the fastest growing race. We're the highest income earners. We're the best educated, and we have tremendous buying power. And so basically what I did see, I live in a city called Arcadia, which is in the San Gabriel Valley. And if you're not familiar with it, it's Southern California, but the San Gabriel Valley is where many Asian ethnicities flock to over, you know, since the 1990s. And so I've had the benefit of seeing real estate invested by primarily Asians coming out of Asia. So all I did is I used that same thesis, and I've I'm just accessing a different source of capital, which is primarily institutional and private equity. So the ambiculture part of it, ambi means marrying of two things. So I'm taking Western real estate and I'm coupling it with Eastern concepts, and that's where the two meet, and that's why it's called ambiculture.
Gotcha. And what's so unique about those communities, because you mentioned that, and I agree with you, if you look at the statistics, higher wage earners, very educated, brilliant, you know, communities and people, what are the unique aspects of the Asian community that would make your model stand out from, you know, a typical white American model?
I mean, I think first off, it's important for folks to know that, excuse me, Asian American culture isn't monolithic. So each one of our subgroups, we operate very differently, right? So you know, I'm just going to use some of the groups that I focus on as examples. Chinese is price over presentation. So they're all about value. So when you're looking at, you know, by way of example, if you're looking at, as an investor, if I'm underwriting a deal out here in the San Gabriel Valley, I probably would, I would model less in tenant improvements, because to your, I'll say stereotypical Chinese, if it's price over presentation, if a space that they walk into looks too nice, then in their mind, they're paying for too much for the service or the product that they're buying, right? So I would model less in tenant improvements in these types of projects than I would in other projects. The Japanese are the complete opposite. The Japanese are presentation over price. So if you ever go to Japan, or if you go to a store that's Japanese led, even the way they package their things and hand them to you, it's almost very ceremonious like, because they're all about presentations or presentation.
Like the business card with two hands, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then that's a total, I'll share another faux pas with you later on down the line about what I did and I didn't know. But Filipinos, for instance, because we were colonized by Americans, Filipinos idolize anything coming out of the United States. Anything. It's actually crazy to see it and then go back to the Philippines and experience why that happens. Vietnamese are much like the Chinese, value for their money. So, you know, when looking at my investment thesis, it's when I go to a market, it's figuring out which one of the subgroups are in the market and how the behavioral patterns are different than the other subgroups. And so, you know, I've spent the bulk of, I don't know, let's call it the last 15 years as a cultural scientist when it comes to Asian American real estate.
Yeah. You know, that is actually a very powerful thought. And most people don't realize that. Fortunately, I've been to many parts of Asia quite a few times. And so I've picked up on all those differences and everything else. But it's quite amazing, because if you look at Black culture, you know, yeah, we're very diverse and everything else. But in a lot of ways, we have the same mindset about things, because we're all from here for the most part, you know, and pretty much the same with white America. But you're absolutely right. Most people think Asian is Asian is Asian, and they like to call you all Chinese all the time. But the diversity and the differences are vast, you know?
I think I mentioned to you that my husband is Black. And so when he's gotten better about identifying what type of Asian people are based on like nose and eyes and stuff. But at the end of the day, he's like, you're all some form of Chinese. You're either like Chinese Filipino or Chinese Vietnamese. I'm like, oh my God, you need to shut up.
Oh man, you must really love him.
30 years, Joel.
Yeah, yeah. Boy, oh boy, that's great. Well, I guess after 30 years, he could get away with that. Oh man, that's crazy. You're all some type of Chinese.
But to that, you know, when we talk about that, like, when you think about, it's not just Asian Americans, when you think about Hispanics, for instance, you know, our kids right. But they were all born and my kids were all born and raised here in LA. Mm-hmm. We had, and aren't even kids, they're like grown ass people now. So our eldest is 25. She's living in New York. She went to Hofstra for school, but my husband and I were talking to her about the Hispanics there. And if you're here in LA, most of the Hispanics that we encounter are primarily Mexican, but when you're on the East Coast, they're not. They're, you know, Puerto Rican, Dominican, right? Yep. And so even, you know, their culture and their behavior is a little bit different. So it's based on wherever. I mean, you go down to Miami, and you know, it's primarily everybody Cuban. Everybody that came from Central California, well, Central America, and Cuba. So it just depends on where you're coming from in the U.S.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good point from that standpoint. Then you mentioned about those cultural differences. Like I said, I was joking a minute ago, but I made the mistake of being over in Singapore, and, you know, I was at a tech event. So I was like, well, you know, I'm not going to need a business card because everybody's going to do digital because it's a tech event. How blown away I was, where everybody had a business card. It was presented with two hands, as I mentioned, like this, and you're actually shocked that, or they were shocked at me at not having a business card. It was like, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, you got to be kidding me, right? You actually have business cards.
So. Well, I myself have learned over the years, again, like I was telling you, have become more of an Asian American cultural scientist, but I walked into a meeting with a potential Chinese partner, and I was with another Chinese partner, and this woman handed me her card with both hands, and I put it on the table. And you probably learned it now, like there's mm-hmm. a hierarchy. When you lay the business cards down, you're supposed to lay them down in the order of who is more superior. Mm-hmm. So if there are four people, you actually, when you're sitting down, you have to line them up just that way. So in any event, we were meeting with this one woman, and I didn't have anything to write on, but I wanted to take a note. While she was speaking to me, I grabbed the back of her card, I flipped it over, and I wrote on it. Mm. And when I got in the car, when we walked out of the office building, my partner, who's Chinese, looked at me. He goes, I don't know if you didn't know what you just did was wrong. I go, what? He goes, you literally took her card and you wrote on the back of it. He's like, you should have just taken your Sharpie and wrote all over her face, because that is the equivalent of what you did. So anyway, you live and learn. But needless to say, I have not done a deal with that woman.
Yeah, I was about to say, I guess you didn't get your funding. So, Yep. Boy, oh boy. Now, let me ask you something. And you know, for all of you watching and listening to this, none of this is scripted. So if you don't have an answer to this, don't worry about it. But one thing that I think is really curious is how the East Asians, or I guess that would be the Indians, you know, actually have done so well in the hotel space. One statistic said that there's 60% of all hotels are owned by Indian Americans, which, you know, technically classifies as part of Asia. Any idea how they have been so successful, and why can't that model be replicated through the other parts of the Asian community, which is what it appears you're trying to do?
To be honest with you, and you know, don't hate me for saying this, I actually don't focus a lot on the Indian community. And if we really want to dive down into it culturally, I'd heard through some Indian friends that they're offended by other Asians, that we don't consider them really? Asians. And so, I mean, you know, Asians, I'm not saying anything that you don't know, but, mm-hmm. you know, beyond many Asians being racist, many Asians are colorists, and many Indians coming from that part of Asia are darker. And so that could kind of play into why some Asians don't consider Indians and, you know, other groups Asians, but they are. So I don't have the answer to the question, but, you know, super proud that they're in this space and doing well. I did hear something, though, that mm-hmm. based on an Indian's last name, you can tell the origin of their family. So, this was a story told to me by an Indian woman. So, you know, if your listeners are out there and want to start throwing darts at me, I can't remember the woman's name, but she had said, for instance, if your last name is Patel, then more than likely your family is in the hotel industry, and they came from a certain part of India. But that's the extent of my Indians in the hotel knowledge.
Yeah. No, I got you. All right. Well, that's fine. And I certainly respect that answer. You know, it's amazing. You talk about that prejudice issue, because you even have the lighter Asians and the darker Asians, you know, the ones that are from Southeast Asia, sometimes get looked down on. And then you have Northern Indian, Southern Indian. It's just ridiculous. Everywhere you go, there's some issues. So it's sad that it is that way, but it is what it is.
I mean, they call my people jungle Asians.
Really? Wow.
I mean, I was just having this conversation yesterday with a girlfriend of mine that is Filipina. And she was just telling me how I just told her that I just witnessed this Chinese guy at the pharmacy berating a Filipina woman. And she says, but you know that they do that a lot in Asia, because many of the Filipinos are the laborers there. And so they get the brunt of you know, people that are not satisfied with customer service. And I guess in Asia, you can be a little bit more aggressive, and maybe it's okay to, you know, put your fist up. But I'm like, this guy's looking to get arrested. You can't do that here in the US.
Yeah. Wow. Sad situation. So,
yeah,
you know, we'll see how that all plays out. Just to pivot a little bit, I want to talk a little bit about your work with FIRE. You know, I looked at the board of directors there, and you really have kind of a dream team, a Filipino dream team that's been put together. So very proud of you guys and what you've accomplished. What really is, for our audience, what is FIRE? What's the objective? And, you know, what are you guys actually hoping to achieve?
So FIRE was started back in 2009. The co-founders of the, it's the brainchild of Gloria Gill and Lou Camlis. And to be fair, Gloria has been my mentor for the last close to 30 years, which is unheard of, because if you're Filipino, normally either your family members are from these, you know, from the career path of a doctor, a nurse, an attorney, an accountant, an engineer, or architect. If you do not want to fall into any of those career paths, there's really no resource for you, because that is what our families know. So I fell into real estate in 1993. I met Gloria probably in 95 or 96, and she has been my mentor for the better part of the last three decades. And so in 2009, she was at, can't recall if she was running real estate over at La Sera or UC Regents, but she was talking to a good friend of hers that they would see each other at the PREA conference circuits. Another Filipina woman named Lou Canlis, I think at one point she ran Ohio Fire and Police and Mass Prim, but the two of them said, you know, we should start a group for Filipinos in institutional real estate. And so that's how that started. So we first came together, one of our current board members, is Barbara Jessel. She hosted us at the Getty. And I think we started off with 10 people at that lunch, and we have now morphed into a full-blown nonprofit organization. So in 2019, after 10 years, we decided that, you know, we were going to be big girls and create an organization specific to the mission of educating, mentoring, and networking Filipinos in institutional real estate. And so now we have chapters in San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, Chicago, the Mid-South, New York City, New England, Las Vegas, and Hawaii. And we just opened up our first international chapter in the Philippines, which, one, is a dream come true, but two, you know, boy, it hits differently, because when you're, we even had this whole conversation about whether we should continue to call it FIRE in the Philippines. And I didn't understand why the board was bringing that up. And I said, why is that an issue? I mean, why wouldn't we brand as FIRE? And they had said, Jennifer, it's the equivalent of saying, if we started a group here, it's the equivalent of saying Americans in institutional real estate. And I go, oh, so anyway, you know, it's things like that, that you don't really think about, but we already had a reputable brand. And so we continue to brand is FIRE in the Philippines.
Yeah. That actually would be funny. Americans and institutional. Yeah, I guess so. Oh man. So is part of the focus to have potentially Filipino investors invest in the United States in projects here as well? I mean, most people view the Philippines as a poor country, but if you've ever been to Manila, and I have, it's a huge metropolis mm-hmm. that rivals New York City in size and stature. So would that be the intent? And obviously there's a lot of money over there that could be invested across the ocean.
I mean, that it, for someone personally, that could be their initiative. But for FIRE as an organization, we went over to the Philippines for several reasons. One, we wanted to bridge Filipino Americans and Filipinos from the Philippines so that we could share best practices. Okay. Two, we'd like to find a way if FIRE in the U.S. could share our best practices so that we can help apply some of those same values to the Filipino market to help attract institutional capital to the Philippines. And then I think pie in the sky is we eventually want to find a way to bring students from the Philippines to come train here with institutional groups, you know, for an internship through an exchange program, and then bring what they have learned from the U.S. back to the Philippines to apply to that market. But, you know, I personally had a couple of conversations with some of those larger Filipino investors that you are talking to. And they are, I mean, part of the reasons why, you know, as I had those discussions, part of the reasons why they haven't been investing in the U.S. is because they haven't found trusted sponsors to work with. And so I think FIRE is helping with that, you know, bring some folks that come full transparency and with a big, you know, whether it's big business cards or, you know, a big background to those different groups. But, you know, when you think about institutions, right, in the United States, the big institutions that run the money in this country are primarily pension funds, life companies. In other countries, it's, you know, sovereign wealth. For us, it's also endowments. They don't have that in the Philippines. In the Philippines, the money that moves the meters are, you know, the money that moves the meter would be conglomerates, which are primarily big family offices. Mm-hmm. And these big family offices, for the most part, run the funding in that country.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I could definitely see that being the case. You know, it's a different animal, but you have that across Asia, even like in Singapore, for an example, there's a few families that pretty much, you know, it's their show, you know, for the most part. So,
right.
Yeah, I get that. So that's quite interesting. So that's good. The mentorship program, has there been any initiative for younger ones or other ones that you might want to announce at this time, or that might already be out there that the public's not aware of for Filipinos?
You know, so we're working with our Philippine Executive Council on a mentorship program there, very much like what we're doing here at FIRE in the U.S. And so we have a full robust program that just started. The new cohort for FIRE's mentorship just kicked off about a week or two ago. And, you know, to have someone that looks like you to guide you through your career can't be discounted. I mean, you know, I know that I'm mentoring for Reese right now. I've mentored for ULI in the past. Obviously I mentor for FIRE, but there's something to be said when you're paired up with someone that understands you, you know, from an ethnic and a cultural standpoint. And so, you know, if there are young listeners out there, whether you're Filipino or not, the FIRE has a full blown mentorship program. But, you know, to that extent, and I don't think you and I spoke about this, Joel, I have two other kids that could be interested in real estate. One is definitely interested and the other one's talking about it. And so what I was saying to these kids is, you know, when I was growing up, that path into a real estate career was not paved for me. I did not have the blueprint. And now that I have the blueprint, I'm doing everything that I can to guide my own children into these opportunities. So thankfully through my network, I got my kids into, you know, the CBRE program, mm-hmm. The Eastel program. I have one of our kids is at Howard right now, and the Starwood guys have been incredibly encouraging and have been advocating for her. And so, you know, she's got an internship that she's starting off in New York. And so to the young students and emerging professionals out there, take advantage of the fact that there are these programs out there that can guide you through, you know, how to get through real estate. And unlike, you know, probably Joel and myself, we fell into what we did. Nobody told us what was available out there. And mm-hmm. so I've stuck to what I know. But, you know, if you get into one of these programs and you try out different facets of real estate, you'll probably figure out at an early age what it is that you want to do.
Yeah, yeah. Because there's a lot of different paths that you could take in commercial real estate, that's for sure. So right. You know, that's a powerful thing. So let me ask you this question. And, you know, and I want to preface this by saying we deeply appreciate you and your involvement. But why did you feel the interest to jump into AREP? I'm sure it's more than just being married to a Black guy. You know, what was the reason and the impetus behind that? And again, I want to preface it by saying, you know, we love you and we're happy to have you as part of it. But, you know, you're focused on Asian productivity. So why the crossover?
Yeah, every day of the week, you know that I'm Filipino. But, you know, to give you background on what ARAP was before, mm-hmm. I think we started the LA chapter in 2013. But the years leading up to that, we were just a drinking club. I mean, it was just a bunch of us that got together informally every quarter and would get together over drinks. And mm-hmm. one day, an attorney called me and said, you know, would you consider taking this organization and formalizing it? I'm like, oh, you're talking to the wrong person. So I sent him over to Kim Brown. And from there, you know, she cobbled together our original board. And we sat down. I clearly remember this, Kim's office, Cushman & Wakefield, Long Beach. And there was probably 13 of us sitting around this table. And we were about to sign the chapter documents. And I looked at everyone and I said, before we sign this, I go, you all know that I'm not Black, right? And so they all started laughing. And I remember Lynn Tolliver looking right at me and she goes, Jennifer, Black is not a race. It's an attitude and you got it. And I said, okay, well, I just, right. you know, I want to make sure, because there was this one woman, you know what my biggest fear is, Joel? Mm-hmm. There was one woman that worked for, I think it was the NAACP. And I think they later found out that she wasn't Black, even though she represented that she was Black. That's what I didn't want. Like I, you know, like I said to you, every day of the week, I am flying, you know, this flag that I'm Filipino. So I don't ever want anybody thinking that, that I'm perpetrating being something else. But to that extent, I've been very inclusive from, you know, the moment that sound came out of my sassy mouth. And so to mm-hmm. me, I feel like even with fire, I say this to folks all the time. If you don't have to be Filipino to be part of fire, if you come into a room and you see all these Filipinos and you've got enough swag to stand there and be there with us, come. We, you know, we're here for everyone.
Yeah. Well, good. I appreciate that. And you know, your work has been impressive, so we certainly appreciate it. You mentioned a location in the Southeast. Do you know what city it's based out of offhand? Your chapter, well, the fire chapter is what I'm talking about.
Oh, in the Mid-South?
Yeah. So would that be Mid-South as like Texas or something, or?
Right. So we actually had our chapter lead for the Mid-South was based out of Bentonville, Arkansas.
Okay.
And you could probably figure out who he worked for. Yeah. And so he was going to run that chapter. He ended up going to go run a bigger real estate program. And so he started the New England chapter based out of Rhode Island, so Boston okay. and that market. So we're currently looking for a Mid-South chapter lead, preferably to be based out of Texas, if anybody out there knows anyone.
Gotcha. Okay, well, now that's out there to the world. So we'll see how that plays out. Yep. So one last thing I want to cover, because I always want these podcasts to be beneficial to our audience. And, you know, we're really talking about access to capital for, you know, BIPOC across the board, right? We're trying to get that access. And what would you say as regards readiness? What do individuals need to know as regards their readiness in order to qualify to get these funds that you're working so hard to get for emerging managers?
I mean, I think we could talk about a couple of different things here, Joel, because, you know, I feel like there are folks that either came into the industry or have been in the industry that feel like they're experienced enough to go and raise a fund just because money's available through mm-hmm. emerging manager programs and social impact funds. But it's not as easy as that. I mean, right. When I started my second platform, one of my partners used to work for one of the big consultants. And what she did as a favor to us is she pulled out the consultant questionnaire and said, before you even consider raising a fund, here are the five things that you need to go do. And I remember the three top things that she wanted us to go do was to get our deck done, get an office space, and get our first deal done. And that took 2 years. So if you think that you're going to go out and raise money without having, you know, certain tools in your tool chest, you're sadly mistaken. So, you know, groups that are out there, I mean, even last week when I had a panel of capital providers, when we talked about it, one of the investment officers from one of the local pension funds said it, if you don't have your first deal done, do not call them. So go and get that. Even if that first deal is a $3 million deal, it shows them that you have the wherewithal to get a deal done. So go out there, get that first deal done, and then go back and start talking to different groups about allocations and accessing capital. The second part of this would be to folks that are out there that have been doing this for a while, whether or not they should go and raise a fund. And I've got, you know, I like this saying, just because you can doesn't mean you should, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sure, you can go out there and raise a fund, but sit down with yourself and figure out how do you like to spend your time? So, you know, I shared the story that my GP partner told me when I started my last platform. He had said, don't go raise a fund. He's like, I know you and you like deals. Just raise capital deal by deal. And to be honest with you, Joel, I mean, if we're real estate people, right?
Yeah.
If you have a good deal, you will always find the capital for it. So I probably will never raise a fund. You know, I'm 50 years old now, and the statistic is you start to make money after you raise your third fund. And so, you know, at 50, even after raising that first fund, how old will I be, you know, at raising that third fund? Yeah. I think people have to really take a good look at what it is that you want to do, what it is that you're good at doing, and then what's the probability of you getting to the end goal of, you know, whatever your current dream is.
Yeah, that's a good answer. Would you direct your kids perhaps in that space? Because then they don't have the age issue that they're running up against.
I mean, it depends on what they want to do. If you're, you know, I'm at this point now in life, raising three kids and having managed a large staff and having mm-hmm. managed just one or two people, I don't want the HR headache. So yeah. If you want that HR headache, and I don't want to say a headache, if you want to go and run a large organization, if you want to build that team so that you guys can figure out how to get deals done, but then also send your marketing people out on a roadshow to go raise that capital. If you want to manage all the auditors that are going to come into your office, all of the compliance on the reporting, go do it. Go raise that fund.
Yeah. But I think your key point was well taken. You have to do what you love. And if you don't want to sit in an office doing all that, you'd rather be out there making deals happen and doing deals, then it becomes pretty obvious what you need to do.
I mean, I think at this point in my, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years, 1993. Mm-hmm. At this point in my career, my focus is, you know, where I can take my experience, which is real estate, and couple it with my community and find that intersection, because that's really for me where the magic lies. So, you know, there was a point in time when I first invested in Hawaii. I came home and I was saying to my mom that I couldn't believe how there are many Filipinos in Hawaii that are the laborers of the market. And mm-hmm. so I talked to, when I closed on one of my first buildings, I was talking to the day matron. She was cleaning the bathroom. And I had asked her, what did she do in the Philippines? And she told me that she used to be an accountant. And so mm-hmm. then I said to her, I go, well, why are you cleaning bathrooms? And the first thing that they always say is it's the language barrier. So they're insecure mm-hmm. In their English and the way they speak. But then secondly, it's because their families that came to the U.S., told them that this is the easiest path for them to make money. Mm. So, you know, go to Las Vegas, Joel, and talk to some of the Filipinos there that work at the casino. They'll tell you they used to be superintendents in the Philippines. They were doctors. They were, you know, they were attorneys. There are so many different things. So the conversation with my mom was that I want to do something to help my community so that we can continue to elevate and get rid of those stereotypes. And she just says to me, you know, this is 20 years ago. And she had said, Jennifer, you have young kids and tuition to pay. So focus on that. And then when you make enough money and you have time to focus on these social projects or, you know, your little passion projects, then go do it. And so, you know, again, here I am, my kids are grown. You know, I've had the benefit of having an incredible mentor, have created a huge network. And so any way that I can help my own communities or marginalized communities, that is what, you know, that is where my passion lies.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's great that you had a part of your life now where you can do that. You know, everybody doesn't get there. You know, they work, they drop, right? So, right. So kudos to you for being able to do that. That's
thank you.
That's very impressive. So I appreciate that. So I would say one takeaway from today is for anyone listening, to be ready to get this capital. All good deals will get capital. You know, you made that real clear. And that's kind of a mantra in the industry anyway, right? We understand that good deals, the money will flow to. But then also you made a very good point about getting that first deal done. And I know a lot of people, they struggle with that. I get phone calls all the time, especially from, you know, REAP and AREP and different individuals in these groups as to how do I get that first deal done? What would you say as we close out for the day would be the greatest advice to help people to appreciate? How do you get that first deal done? Because that's often the challenge. You know, you're buying something for, you use the number $3 million. So we'll use $3 million as a number, right? You got to have, you know, you might give 1.7, 1.8 in debt. You got to bring $1.2 million in equity or whatever the number is, $1.3 million. How do you do that? You know, what would you suggest to people like that?
So there are GP partners out there that if you don't have that GP co-invest, if you don't have the deposit, there are GP partners out there that you can access to help you with that piece that you're missing. But to that extent, if you don't know where those groups are, go and get a GP advisor. I'm happy to, you know, take a phone call and have a conversation with these groups that have had experience challenges or just don't know how to get that first deal done. But, you know, again, at the panel the other day, pension fund investment officer said the same thing, go and get a GP advisor. So you got to get someone that can tell you how to get it done. And I know that it can be frustrating, but it's more frustrating when you're flying around the country trying to access this capital and they're all telling you the same thing. So, you know, cancel all your flights. Don't go anywhere else. The first thing that you need to do is get your first deal done and then go out and start trying to go get money.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, very good advice. You know, and the thing about it is if you've got the fortitude and the desire to get it done, you'll get it done. You know, it's just might take a minute, but you'll get there. So we appreciate that advice. Anything else that you would like our audience to know as we wrap up today? It's been a pleasure having you, and I'm really excited about the work that you're doing. Can't wait to get back out there to LA and see some of the projects that you're involved in. But what would you want our audience to know as we wrap up for today?
If they have any questions, you know, I'm an open door. Feel free to reach out to me. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can message me. You know, again, if you are on the GP side of things and you're hitting a wall, happy to, you know, have a conversation with you. If you know Filipinos in the industry that are looking for a very intentional trade organization, send them over to FIRE, you know, and Joel, thank you for doing this. I mean, I think that these types of programs with, you know, faces that look like you are much needed. But, you know, you have an impressive roster of speakers that you've had. So I appreciate you reaching out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're impressive too. So feel good about that.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I certainly appreciate it. It's very good information. And, you know, again, that's what we're here to do. We're here to try to push that, move that needle, if you will, instead of it being 3-5% of the industry being, you know, BIPOC, let's see if we can move that up to, you know, a much larger number, right? If you look at the Asian community and the Black community, we probably make up, you know, 20-30% of this population in this country. So it should be more evenly balanced. And I think everybody would benefit for it. So, you know, so Jennifer, hey, greatly appreciate it. You know, you've got a great mind on your shoulders, and I know you were going to provide some valuable insights. I wish you well in all your endeavors as you continue to try to raise this equity. I'm sure you'll be successful in those endeavors. And certainly would love to talk to you about other stuff that we're even doing across the country, and see if we can benefit some, you know, other neighborhoods of color as well, especially the Asian community as well. So we certainly appreciate you, Jennifer, and thanks so much for being here today.
Great to see you, Joel. See you soon.
All right. Thank you. So for all you guys, this has been the Mornings with Joel CRE podcast. We thank you for being here today. Tune in next week for another exciting show. Thank you so much.